Life's better with American Family Insurance because our home policies help protect your dreams and come with peace of mind. Save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Extra time.
Hello and welcome back to the Extra Time podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten, and this week I'm joined by Doogie Critchley. Hello, Doogie.
Hello, Pat. You all right?
Yeah, I'm good, man. How are you? How have things been? How was your weekend after the horrible announcement that we're heading back into lockdown?
Yeah, well, I've actually already been in lockdown. I got ahead of everyone. I've had coronavirus, so I've had to be inside for 2 weeks. So just as I hit freedom tonight, we're going back in pretty much. So, but yeah, I'm feeling a lot better. It was actually quite nasty, coronavirus. I describe it as like a really, really grim cold. I think I was quite fortunate, obviously, in the grand scheme of things. But yeah, it wasn't particularly pleasant, but I'm feeling a lot better now, which is nice.
Well, I mean, my favourite bit about it was the enormous sympathy you got at the team meeting when you told everyone you had coronavirus, which was just everyone making a little loser sign at you in the camera. I thought was a bit rough.
It's difficult to, you know, over Zoom to give that much emotion as it is. But yeah, I was expecting maybe someone to say like, get well soon in the comments or something. but instead, it was just met by complete silence pretty much on this Zoom meeting. But hey ho, you can't win them all.
Well, I'm glad you're feeling better now anyway, Doogie, because frankly, the hiring process is an absolute nightmare. it is my understanding. But anyway, today we're going to get into some people who've also enjoyed a slightly difficult start to the season, potentially, and some others who are flying high. We're going to talk about the biggest transfers of the summer, give our take on how they've done so far, maybe pick out our flops and our bargains. So I've pulled up, basically, the list of the top 10 most expensive transfers of the summer. Now, in the end, one of those is Mauro Icardi going to PSG on a permanent, so I've ditched that one and replaced it with Leroy Sané. Because Icardi was done last year, no one cares. So I feel like the obvious place to start, given that three of these players went to Chelsea, is with Chelsea. So we've got Kai Havertz, the most expensive player of the summer, £72 million. Timo Werner, the sixth most expensive, £48 million. And then Ben Chilwell at around £45 million. Dukes, how do you feel about Chelsea's performance so far? How do you think these signings are settling? Is there one who's really excelling? Is there one who's lagging behind?
Yeah, I feel like Chelsea have been obviously pretty inconsistent, as most people would probably acknowledge, still finding their sort of best system to fit all these players in. I thought it was interesting that this weekend, prior to the Burnley game, it was actually Timo Werner who dropped out on the bench, and then Pulisic pulled up in the warm-up, so Werner went back in. And I feel like Timo Werner's adapted pretty well. I think he's got about 5 goals in 10 games in all competitions. Not too bad. Although I don't think he's looked at his best at the on the left. I think he's looked much better centrally. His best game was without doubt against Southampton when he was playing down the middle. I think Chilwell's been sort of excellent, really. I can't really find much fault in him whatsoever. And for £50 million, I definitely wouldn't call it a bargain. But sometimes, you know, sometimes players actually prove that £50 million is an okay deal. I mean, look at Kyle Walker a few years ago. I think most people at the time were like, that was an extortionate amount of money. But actually, for the service that Kyle Walker's given, I think he's just passed 100 Premier League games for City. I think he's actually been a really good servant. And they've carried on trying to buy right-backs, but just can't find one better than Kyle Walker. So it feels like Ben Chilwell, with that long-term investment, I think has proved pretty solid. He definitely looks like a much better attacking threat than he did at Leicester in his last couple of years, which is good to see. And he's always been pretty solid defensively. The worry, if there is one, would probably be Havertz, but maybe that's a bit overdramatic at this time. He's definitely played in a few different positions. He looked much better in a midfield three against Burnley, although I was amazed that Chelsea managed to get away with that. A midfield three of Mount, Kante and Havertz away at Burnley. It feels like that was going to be a really tough game for them. But actually, they breezed through it and Hakim Ziyech played really well as well. So Havertz, you'd probably look for as the weaker one of the new signings so far. But yeah, I wouldn't worry about it too much. I mean, he's now at one shot a game, one dribble, 1.3 key passes, which isn't anywhere close to his Bayer Leverkusen numbers, although it's different when you're playing as the focal point and playing as a false nine in the latter part of last year. Just 0.26 expected goals and assists per 90, which is way down on what he's been producing in the last few years. But yeah, I'd say Chilwell, Werner generally pretty solid, and Thiago Silva's made an enormous difference to the back as well. And Edouard Mendy, actually, in the games he's played, I think has looked really, really solid. Not so much his distribution, but actually his shot stopping's looked excellent. So I think there's loads of positives for Chelsea, and they should be where I kind of thought them to be at the start of the season, which is around that third place. I can't see them challenging for the title, but with Man City's deficiencies and Liverpool's injuries at the start of this year, you know, maybe they could get into the title mix, but yeah, I feel like it's a little bit too soon for them so far.
I think the title mix is beyond them, and that's partially because while they are sixth in the table at the moment, I think that in a season where the top sides had not underperformed to the extent they had, Chelsea might actually be a little bit adrift. Mm. Now, I would expect them to kind of get back into it over the course of a season in that situation because they have so much talent. But I do think they've underperformed their talent pretty dramatically so far. I mean, Kai Havertz, yeah, 0.26 expected goals and assists per 90. That is rubbish. Timo Werner, 0.4. That's not great. But it's so early that one or two really good games can dramatically change those numbers, yeah. Right? On the other hand, I do have broader question marks about Chelsea as a side. I think the defence has been poor so far. The defence is conceding about 11 shots a game. I remember Frank Lampard a week or so ago saying that they allow the fewest shots in the league. They don't. There are eight sides that allow fewer shots than them per game. And so I didn't really understand where he was coming from then. And they also give up pretty good chances too. I mean, I think they're allowing something like 1.2 expected goals per game, which is also quite a lot. Mm. So I do expect them to kind of get better because I think all this talent will find its feet. But I also worry about that defence. Like, Chilwell's already playing. Thiago Silva's already playing. Conte is playing. Like, I do think they can improve by getting Jorginho out and getting Kovacic in. I think that would help a lot. And also when there's a consistent pattern in front of them, like, you don't have to pick the same attackers all the time, but you clearly get much more defensive presence from a Mount or a Ziyech than you do from a Havertz. Mm. And I think that probably makes life a little bit difficult for the defenders again. I mean, I think everyone thinks that I'm on this, like, this crusade against Frank Lampard at the moment, and I'm not really. It's just that I think he now has everything in place to do a very good job, and Chelsea at the moment don't actually look that good. Like, I mean, that is the thing. Like, when I look at Chelsea at the moment, I'm like, they look fine.
Yeah.
But I would want them to be like, we are clearly an excellent side, comfortably in the mix for the top four. Like, I don't think they look really better than Spurs at the moment.
No.
I'm not sure they even really look better than, say, a Leicester.
And they haven't really had concern. Sorry, they haven't really had massive injury issues as well.
No.
In the same way that Liverpool have, Man City have. I mean, Pulisic has been out for a bit. Ziyech has just come back as well. But, you know, you should be able to get better performances out of, you know, Kante, Kovacic, Abraham, Werner, Havertz, Mount, etc. I think Mount's actually been one of their brightest points this so far this season. I think he's gone from that level where he looked very useful in the Premier League to he's actually kind of been their main man so far this season. I think he's actually been really impressive. My biggest worry about them is actually not really their defence, in terms of, I think they could improve in personnel at centre-back and they would be a better side. But it's actually in midfield. I feel like Kovacic played alongside Kante in that game against West Brom, and then they conceded three in that first half. And then he hasn't really been played in a midfield two with Kante, which for me is like the way forward for Chelsea.
Yes.
I feel like That is clearly the best composition of their midfield. And then you can play a composition of a Ziyech, Pulisic, Havertz, Mount behind a Timo Werner, with Tammy Abraham getting some games. And I think that should be good enough to win the majority of games in the Premier League quite comfortably. But as you say, it's that defensive deficiencies which comes with playing Jorginho over Kovacic. And I just feel like Kovacic is slightly just being the sort of fall guy really at the moment, which is a bit of a shame.
Yeah, I think that is a really, really strange one, because, like, he was clearly the player of the season last year for them. I kind of agree about Mount. It's a bit interesting to see what role Lampard intends for him, because he's kind of playing in a double pivot sometimes, or Chelsea are kind of lining up in theory with a double pivot, but actually playing something much more like 4-1-4-1. It seemed like that's what they were doing the other day, right? With Conte just covering the whole of the midfield. And maybe that's what they decide to do. Like, if Lampard looks at his defensive personnel and says, this is as good as it's going to get, then he might just say, you know what, I'd rather get another attacker on the pitch and we will just win games, you know, 4-1-4-2. But that's a little bit troubling, I thought, when Cesar Azpilicueta said a similar thing. You know, look, at the moment, it feels like we need to score 3 or 4 goals to win a game because, you know, we just keep conceding. And I thought, well, yeah, that is the sort of thing that I would want a manager to be taking a serious look at. And it's something we haven't really seen Lampard do yet. I think he can coach a pretty competent attack. I think he can coach a competent press. Whether he can actually get the defence working as a whole as a result of that is difficult to tell. But Chelsea, there's loads more scope for improvement. The good thing about these players is Kai Havertz could have 2 poor years for Chelsea and then explode and still be really young. You know, so they've got kind of nothing to worry about there. Chilwell is already a decent contributor, particularly in attack. I think he's got 3 goal involvements so far. And Timo Werner is just reliable. I mean, my worry is his shots are down, his dribbles are down, his key passes are down. But I think that that's probably a systemic thing. And I think that he's going to get his shots as the season goes on. So not too many concerns there. You certainly wouldn't call any of these a waste of money. So shall we move on? Because the next one, I know you do think is a bit of a waste of money, and I can't really disagree with you.
Yeah, I think if I had to pick a flop, I actually think most of the business so far this summer, it was, you know, it turned out to be a busier summer than most people think. I think most of the business has actually been pretty good, but I think the Arta deal to Barcelona with Pjanic, to Juventus with Pjanic going the other way, hasn't really worked out for either side so far. I think Pjanic has played 2 Champions League games, but hasn't started in La Liga yet, despite Busquets' really bad form. kind of baffling. I think he's actually been fine when he has played, but it's weird that he's still not trusted by Koeman. But then Arta, you know, people forget because of the, you know, it worked out at about £12 million overall for Juventus paying that to Barcelona, I think. But he was still £66 million. And he's played 300 league and Champions League minutes so far. It actually, the move, you know, started on a pretty bad footing in that before he left Barcelona, he actually tested positive for drink driving, which wasn't the greatest start. And then he's gone to Juventus and he struggled to break into their team, really. He's only played 2 full 90s so far, one of which was against Spezia this weekend in a 4-1 victory. But hasn't looked brilliant. 2.9 tackles and interceptions per 90. Hasn't had a shot yet. 2 key passes in 4 games and 2 dribbles. And it's not really his game, or at least it doesn't seem like it's his game to regularly contribute in the final third. But 0.02 expected goals and assists per 90 is dreadful. It's sort of like it's like bad for a centre back. You'd think like James Tarkowski or someone like that would produce more than that at Burnley. So for Arta to be doing that at Barcelona, and I don't think their whole midfield has looked particularly comfortable so far under Pirlo, which is the area that you'd think that he'd get the biggest sort of increase, although the sort of logic that great midfielders coach great midfields is maybe a little bit loose. But when I watched them against Barcelona, I thought Rabiot was really poor once again in a big game. Very little impact in either end, really. And Arta just hasn't really got going yet at Juventus. And while he looks comfortable on the ball, in possession, as he always does, it's kind of difficult to see what he really is as a player yet. So, yeah, troubled times for the Brazilian in Turin.
Yeah, I think that's interesting, the idea of great midfielders coaching great midfields, because I actually think that quite often limited players make for good coaches because they understand that their players are human and that they have to come up with a system that works around them. Like, I mean, with the exception of Zidane, there aren't really that many top quality coaches around who are also top quality players, really. Yeah. You know, like even Pep Guardiola, who played obviously at a very high level, was by his own admission, extremely like physically limited and learnt to kind of get around that by doing other things. And I think that quite often that's quite helpful. Like when you have players, even Frank Lampard, you know, Frank Lampard is an amazingly talented player, but I wouldn't say that it was necessarily his talent that made him such a superstar. He was also unbelievably hardworking.
Yeah.
And just incredibly intelligent as a player.
Yeah, whenever you see videos of Thierry Henry, I think he's the prime example of great players not necessarily coming across as great coaches. He sort of seems quite patronising to his players. I don't know whether that's just his manner. But yeah, it's definitely not just great players, great coaches, for sure.
Yeah, and you could imagine having that feeling as well as like a brilliant player where you would just say, can't you just do this? Yeah. You know, like Thierry Henry, you can imagine saying to his forwards, why don't you just beat the fullback and like create a chance or something? And they'll be like, because I'm not Thierry Henry. And I do think actually this is quite an issue that's going on with Juventus. So Juventus at the moment have 58% possession, which is third highest in Italy, and the top three are really bunched together. You know, like Inter are like a percentage point higher.
Hmm.
But they're ninth in the league for shots per game and ninth for shots on target. Now, partially that's going to be down to, you know, like chopping and changing formation, though they've had Ronaldo out, though on the other hand, they've played Chiesa as a wing back, which is an extremely attacking decision. And I think Morata has actually been pretty good. I mean, he scored about 15 offside goals already this season. But to me, that is kind of what I worried Juventus were going to be under Pirlo. They'd have loads of possession, but they might be a bit toothless, because if you are a side who wants all the ball, there are plenty of sides, especially in Serie A, who are going to let you do it. And they're not going to be that worried if you don't have someone like Pirlo who can produce something magical to create a chance out of nothing. And Juventus don't really have that person. Like, at the moment, they're extremely reliant on Kulusevski. I think Kulusevski's a really exciting young player, but a good 19-year-old probably shouldn't be starting for Juventus right now. You know, like, the team should be a little bit better than that. So I am a bit concerned with their creativity. I think Arthur's numbers are extremely worrying. His numbers last year were also very worrying. So I just don't really know what he is. And he's not as young as people think he is. I mean, he's getting into his mid-20s. At the very least, you'd want to have an idea of the player he's going to turn into. Like Kai Havertz, his numbers aren't great right now, but we know exactly what Kai Havertz is probably going to turn into.
Well, yeah, and Arthur's been in Europe for 3 years now.
Yeah.
So it's not like he's new to the league. You know, often the transition from Brazil to Europe isn't actually that easy. But yeah, you just expect to see way more from him. The good thing for Juventus is that Ronaldo's going to come back from COVID. Dybala's been in and out of the side, had a really difficult time getting over coronavirus too. I think he tested positive for about four times. He'll hopefully be integrated into the side, although there is that on-running contract issue surrounding him as well. So I think Juventus will get better, but they can't really afford to leave too big a gap with AC Milan, because they just don't look like they're going to lose like really any more than two or three games this year, AC Milan, really. So they just look like a phenomenal side all of a sudden. So a little bit troubling for Pirlo and Juve.
Yeah, Juve are a really lopsided squad, like both because of their work in the summer and because of their work over the last few seasons in the transfer market. And when you have a lopsided squad that requires some problem solving, I don't think you want a manager in his first job to be trying to figure it out. Like, that is a really difficult task, even for a sophisticated manager who's been doing this for years. You know, like problem solving type of managers, like say Luis Enrique, is kind of a problem solver rather than an ideologue like Pep. When it's a guy who spent about 10 minutes with the under 23s and had to finish his coaching badges at the beginning of the season, like, you are basically just hoping that Pirlo turns out not just to be like a decent coach, but turns out to be an above average top flight coach in one of Europe's top five leagues, and those aren't actually that common. So shall we cheer ourselves up by staying in Serie A with a signing which I think is working out much, much better, and that is Victor Osimhen, who went to Napoli for £63 million in the window. And Napoli, I think, look really good this season. They've lost two games now, so they are down in fifth, but I think their stats overall are excellent. They're top in the league for shots with 19 a game. They're top for shots on target with 7.4 a game. And Osimhen's numbers have been absolutely ridiculous. I think he's only got two goal involvements in four starts, but it's clear that the goals are going to start coming, because he's taking over five shots a game with nearly five from inside the box. He's creating two chances a game, 1.4 dribbles. I mean, it seems like somehow Gattuso has managed to hit on a really effective attacking setup there, you know, with Mertens, Insigne, Lozano, and Osimhen, and obviously Fabian Ruiz behind them. I mean, how far do you think Napoli can go this season, Dukes?
Well, it's been a, as you say, really impressive start. I think Osimhen's looked just really... I didn't really know he had the sort of physical capabilities that he does. He looks really, you know, strong. He's, his hold-up play has been magnificent. His sort of awareness of where his teammates are. I mean, yeah, as you say, only two goal involvements in four starts, but he actually could have been much higher, and he completely dominated a game against Atalanta, which is a really good sign as well, because although they're not the best defensively, they're still one of the better teams in Serie A. He played really well against Genoa in the highlights that I saw as well. And Gattuso getting more out of Irving Lozano, having been pretty much persona, you know, non grata in about January, February time, is a really nice revival there too. I'd probably say their depth across the back four maybe isn't good enough for a sustained title challenge. And I still think it's baffling that they use Ospina in goal over Mere. But yeah, I mean, if you've got Giovanni Di Lorenzo, who's a pretty good right back, and then they've got Hysaj, who's having a bit of a revival at left back as well. And Mario Rui as a backup left back. I mean, their fullback area isn't too bad. And then Zielinski, Fabian Ruiz in midfield. And then, you know, a plethora of options up front. They could be in quite a good... could be in quite a good position. The only troubling thing is that Milik has been completely frozen out. Europa League and Serie A squads he's not involved in will definitely leave in January, and they won't really receive the fee that they should have for Milik. So that's a bit of a downside in terms of their transfer dealings. But yeah, I mean, Gattuso, surprisingly, turning into a bit of an attacking guru in Naples. I mean, who would have thought it? And they're getting plenty of opportunities, and I think they'll be firmly in the top four mix. But yeah, title challenge probably a bit out of their grasp.
Yeah, I think that attack is so good that they will probably be able to like ride it to a top four place. Like, it's not guaranteed. Serie A is really, really competitive this year. Like you said, Inter look, I mean, they look incredible right now. Juve, we assume, have got to get it together. Atalanta, still very, very solid. But it feels like that fourth spot is there. I mean, like, Milan, I think, are going to be ahead of Napoli. But, like, it does feel like these teams have sort of... I don't want to say appeared out of nowhere, because they were, you know, obviously Milan were very good post-lockdown. But given the state that these clubs were in as recently as the spring, they've really turned things around very quickly. And it does just show that, like, having everybody pulling together and having a couple of elite forwards can get you an awfully long way. I mean, we might see the same thing happening with Everton, to be honest. So yeah, I don't know. I'm quite bullish on Napoli, and I would like them to be kind of good again. And I also always enjoy a side that's like, we've got an amazing attack, our defense isn't all that. We don't really care. We're just going to outshoot you. We're just going to take 20 shots a game. And to be honest, like, I certainly can't think of a team that have ever taken this many shots at a game and not ended up in the Champions League, and actually have not ended up quite close to a title race. So, yeah, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see where they go. So just before we move on to the second half of our transfer special, wanted to bring you a quick word from our sponsors, Beer 52. Now, obviously, lockdown is looming again, and so you may be a little sick of generic store-bought beer. So why not remedy that problem by signing up with Beer 52? They send you craft beers. That's what they are, a craft beer discovery club. They've got over 150,000 members, and if you sign up with them, then every month you get sent a brand new case of beers. These have different themes, so you might get all South Korean beers, you might get American beers or South African beers. If you don't like dark beer, you can check an option and you'll only get sent light beers as well, if you don't want to get too dark now the winter months are approaching, sitting on your own in your house. But honestly, it's a really great way to discover new things. When we've had Michael McCubbin on, he said that he discovered a couple of new beers through Beer 52 and then ended up actually ordering more of those beers from the breweries themselves. So it's also a really good way to discover small businesses, which you can then support. And that's something we should obviously all be doing right now. Given that you can't go out and explore, why not explore the world of beer through Beer 52? You just go to beer52.com/extra and you cover £5.95, which is the postage, and in return you'll get a crate of 8 free beers. That's beer52.com/extra, £5.95, that's just the postage for the beers. Pretty amazing deal. So yes, we heartily encourage you to take advantage of that. And let's move on to our next few transfers. So next up, we've got Manchester City. We're going to do them together because we've got Ruben Dias and Nathan Ake. Now, this pair cost over £100 million put together, but City, Dougs, are not in the greatest defensive form of Pep's time there.
No, not in the greatest form all over the pitch, really. I haven't really enjoyed watching City that much this season, which is really weird because over the last few years, even last year, I thought they were an excellent watch. But this year, it's so slow, it's so ponderous, there's not enough width in the side, which is absolutely crucial. I don't know why they got rid of Angelino, who would have been a great left-sided defender. João Cancelo has played okay there, but he wants to come inside. Sterling wants to come inside all the time. Foden wants to come inside. Mahrez always comes inside. There's just not enough width. And it's not that entertaining to watch at the moment. And you will temper that with De Bruyne has missed some games. Aguero's missed a lot of games. Gabi Jesus has missed a lot of games. So they aren't at full strength going forward. But you just expect more from them at this stage. And the composition of their midfields hasn't looked great either. I think Rodri is... I can really... I mean, last year I thought your issues with Rodri, I thought, were a little harsh at points, to be honest, because the team was still playing so well. And maybe I'm just being a bit of the hindsight police and coming out of it now, but I haven't really been that impressed with Rodri so far in a single pivot. I actually think he's looked pretty good when he's playing alongside Fernandinho, but his passing isn't exciting enough. He's not brave enough on the ball, and he looks like he can be overrun, you know, with quick runners around him quite easily. Having said that, he did have quite a good game against Sheffield United, which I did watch at the weekend. So he's blowing hot and cold at the moment, but it's still a little bit troubling that I'm kind of yearning for a 35-year-old Fernandinho to get back in there. And then defensively, Ruben Dias, haven't really seen enough of him to prove that he is, like, you know, one of the best centre-backs in the league. Haven't seen enough of him to suggest otherwise, though. He looks pretty solid. Nathan Ake, I think, is a weird pickup, to be honest. You know, adds depth at left back, adds depth at centre back, but for that money, I think they could have probably got a better option, to be fair. I think Skriniar was going for about that price. Spurs just couldn't, you know, trump up the cash in the end. So Nathan Ake is slightly troubling, and he's just not very good in the air as well, which is a bit of an issue for Man City. Ever since Vincent Kompany left, their centre backs haven't looked solid enough in the air. Ake's only winning 60% of his aerial duels. So I just feel like Man City, once again, seem to have got a defensive signing slightly wrong in Nathan Ake. I don't think he was the player that they potentially needed. But yeah, question marks all over the pitch. But at least with the, you know, Liverpool dropping points in games as well, they're not too far off the pace. But they need to get it together quickly.
Yeah, I mean, Ake, I don't think that aerial duel win percentage is that bad, but I also wonder if maybe it's a little bit higher than it is as a centre-back, because he's had some time as a left-back where you tend to be up against slightly smaller players. Like, I mean, he does seem like a weird one, because this is the thing. Sometimes we talk about transfers and people say, well, X player's like perfectly good. What's the problem with this team buying that player? But there's an opportunity cost to buying a player, right? Which is that you didn't buy a different player. And you've spent $40 million on Nathan Ake. Like, I think that money could have been spent better. The same as with Rodri last year. So, like, Rodri last year, I didn't think he was that great. Now, partially that was because I was comparing him to Fernandinho, who was still amazing, even at 34. But also, one of my issues there was really Man City's allocation of resources. I thought going out and buying this midfielder and just trusting him to come in and immediately be as good as Fernandinho is an absolutely insane thing to do. Like, and to have almost no midfield depth as well, and no defensive depth, which is what they did last season. And that's always my issue with Man City. Like, every year, I think you've got so much money. You've got so much money. You've actually just, like, won an incredible victory over financial fair play. And now financial fair play is kind of getting booted down the road a couple of years because of coronavirus. It just seems like this is a real opportunity for them to invest heavily. And they did, but in a way that makes no real sense to me. Like, I find it hard to believe that there's not a kind of left-back, centre-back, in-betweener out there who's better than Nathan Ake and available for you know, under 40-odd mil. Like, I just don't understand it. Nathan Ake's never been a part of an elite defensive unit. Well, I mean, City's... Sorry, go on.
Sorry, could they have just signed, say, Skriniar and Sergio Reguilon?
Yeah, or they could have signed Ben Chilwell for very similar money. Yeah. And Ben Chilwell actually is pretty good in the air. I think he at one point played in a back three at Leicester. So, I mean, and plus he's just a better long-term asset to have. Like, he's younger. I think that he's much more versatile. They still need an elite left-back. Like, when Laporte and Ruben Dias are fit now, I don't see why you'd start Ake. Like, is he their best left-back? Is he better than playing Cancelo there? Is he better than Zinchenko? Is he better than Mendy? Like, probably not. If he is, it's not by much. And when Laporte and Dias are both fit, you're not going to start Ake as a centre-back. Mm. Whereas Chilwell could play basically whoever's fit. Like, Chilwell would be your starting left-back most of the time. And then if you've got centre-back injuries, maybe you could go to a three at the back and you could play him on the left side of a back three and see how that goes. Like, I mean, I just think Ake is just a weird non-solution for City's problems, in my view. And there are problems there. Like, the defence is not great right now. They're still allowing relatively few shots. Well, very few shots. 8.2 a game, which is the second lowest in the league. Brighton actually currently conceding the fewest shots in the league. But the shots they concede are much more like the shots you tend to see pressing sides concede. Like, normally pressing sides give up very few shots, but really high quality shots. We always see that. And City were unusual in the 17-18 season when they got 100 points. They were giving up very few shots, but also very low quality shots. Like, that was really strange. We've almost never seen that before. And now they're back to a much more conventional kind of statistical profile. So only 8.2 shots conceded a game, but 1.2 XG conceded a game, which actually ranks joint 10th in the Prem with Chelsea. You know, so they're worse off than Arsenal in that regard. They're worse off than, you know, teams like Burnley, certainly worse off than teams like Villa. These are not teams with like elite defensive talent. Mm. So I don't know. I just think if the team's defence improves over the course of this season, that's pretty much the only way that I can judge their defensive signings, because City have so much of the ball that their defensive players always have terrible stats, except João Cancelo. Like, they never put up tackles and interceptions. Dias has yet to attempt a tackle in the Premier League.
Wow.
Like, yet to attempt one, which shows like how much of the ball they have and kind of how much protection they have when things are working well. If the defence improves overall, then I'm willing to say that like they got at least Diaz's signing right. If the defence carries on like this for a while, then I will feel completely vindicated and basically say that like the Ake money at least was kind of wasted. And I don't know, I just think that like we're in year 5 of Pep now. I don't think that the team should be in this situation where they're like, Jesus Christ, we need to go out and panic buy a couple of defenders, because the team's just in the mire. And you know, I think that there are players there who have actually had a lot of stick over the years, who are much more consistent than some of the players who you get in trouble for criticising. Like, I think Ilkay Gundogan has been a really great servant for Man City. I think they always look better with him in midfield, but I don't think he gets a lot of credit for it. And yeah, I don't know. I just think Pep's actually got quite a difficult job on his hands this season to sort that defence out, even though I think the attack will be totally fine.
Yeah. I'm less sure about the attack, to be honest. I don't know. It'll be different when Aguero and Gabi Jesus are back, for sure. Mm. But could they have gone out this year, this summer, and knowing the injuries that Aguero gets every year, and knowing that Gabi Jesus' fitness isn't great either, and just got a third striker? Like, most top teams have three, you know, elite strikers. I know it might be difficult to tempt them, but someone young with the potential to play a lot of games, because They do look a bit toothless without a front nine. I feel like there's so many players just going into the same sort of areas, clustering up the centre of the pitch. And, you know, Ferran Torres has done admirably there in the last couple of games. I think he's actually looks like he's way ahead of where I thought he was going to be. I thought it was going to take at least 6 months to adapt to Pep's system. And actually, he looks like scrappy as hell. And I think he's going to be quite a good, useful contributor for them. But I feel like City have got worse than last year, definitely going forward, and they're considerably worse than obviously the year before that. And it feels like Pep's cycle, you know, could end this year with yet another sort of, you know, no league title, which used to be his bread and butter, and you know, City with issues at, you know, throughout the side really, and with another striker needed to replace Aguero And, you know, the squad just looking weaker than it probably did 3 years ago. So, I don't know. I'm not that hot on Man City at the moment, to be honest. I'm quite disappointed in them.
Yeah, I agree, Diggs. Very disappointed in them. Should we move on to another side that I'm disappointed in, which is Barcelona, who obviously spent £54 million on Miralem Pjanic in what looks like quite a dodgy deal, to be honest with you. So obviously they're 12th in the table. Pjanic has played just 73 minutes in La Liga. You actually mentioned this earlier, but he has played most of their two Champions League games. I was a bit worried to see Pedri starting over him in El Clasico. Like, I know they're not the same position, but they could have played a three-man midfield with Pjanic and didn't. It's a very small sample size, but I think already this move looks silly. I think it looked silly at the time. I just think that this is, like, throwing money away, to be honest. Like, maybe Juventus wouldn't have come in and bought Arthur if Barcelona hadn't agreed to take Pjanic as well. But I've got to believe that there was a better way to make money out there than doing this deal, which now is going to have Pjanic locked up on an expensive contract until he's well into his 30s. Dukes, like you said, Busquets has obviously had a pretty poor start to the season. Do you actually think that there's going to be a place for Pjanic, or do you think that... I know it's very early days, but Koeman is not really known for being a flexible guy. Like,
yeah.
Do we expect Pjanic to be like a regular contributor on this side, or are we just looking at a situation where in 2021 we see Barcelona like shopping Pjanic to everybody they can?
Well, the weird thing is, if he's not playing over Busquets at the moment with Busquets in such terrible form, it's pretty concerning, really. Like, why did they bring him in if it wasn't to play regularly and start phasing Busquets out? And the fact they're not playing Ricky Puig either, like, Koeman's just using his midfield resources really strangely. Like, for me, Busquets shouldn't really be anywhere near the first team at the moment. I think it's quite sad, but I think he's basically completely lost it. Not mentally, that makes him sound like he's gone deranged. I just mean, like, his positional play is really bad now. He's just always like 2 or 3 minutes behind. I mean, not literally 2 or 3 minutes, but his like on the ball, he still looks pretty comfortable, but he's making weird decisions at weird times. He's pressing at the wrong times. He's getting passed round so easily now, and he's never really played in a double pivot. So play Pjanic there instead. And then look for a long-term... I mean, it's silly because they should have just signed a long-term midfielder this summer, because Pjanic has, what, got 2-3 years? Someone like a Bentancur or someone like an Ismael Benacer, even better, to play alongside Frankie de Jong, because Frankie de Jong, you could play him as that holding midfielder, but actually I think he's best when he's got the opportunity to break forward a little bit and use his excellent feet in tight spaces. So a real defensive bit, sort of behemoth who has that dribble capability as well, like a Benacer, like a Bentancur, would have been the signing I would have gone for, rather than a 30-year-old Pjanic who, whilst playing okay at the moment, it doesn't seem to be even ahead of a Busquets whose form has collapsed. So just more baffling moves, really.
Yeah, completely agree. I've got nothing to add to that. I think that's very comprehensive. And I'm also going to kind of skip over Leroy Sané here, because I think Leroy Sané, early days for Bayern Munich, exactly what we expected, really.
Yeah.
I mean, I think he's on 1.3 expected goals and assists per 90. He's got 4 goals and assists in 230 league minutes so far. Bayern are top of the Bundesliga. They are joint first on points with Dortmund, but I think they've got a plus 15 goal difference after 6 games. I think
Tasty.
That league is probably done.
It's Der Klassiker this weekend, actually. So if Dortmund win that, maybe. But
yeah, maybe. But I don't know. It seems hard to imagine a season where Bayern don't run away with it. But who knows? So instead, I'm just going to talk to you about Thomas Partey. Let's have a quick chat about Thomas Partey, because there was a lot of praise for him in the Football Daily group chat after Arsenal beat Man United yesterday. I thought he was excellent in the game. To be honest, I thought Mo Elneny was arguably better.
Yeah.
I thought Elneny was probably man of the match. But Thomas Partey, very, very, very small sample so far. Hasn't played much in the league. And it's kind of been a mixed bag for him early doors. He came on in that loss to City. He obviously played in the loss to Leicester. Played in that kind of ropey, just about scraped win over Vienna. The easy win over Dundalk was kind of achieved like with, you know, no real contribution from anyone in particular. That was just like the kids who ran out in that game. But this Man United game was pretty impressive for Arsenal. I know I have thoughts about Thomas Partey, but I'm intrigued to hear yours.
Well, I can only go on what I've seen so far of him in an Arsenal shirt, because obviously everyone knows how good he was at Atletico, but I think he's been excellent, to be honest, at Arsenal. I feel like £45 million, very well spent as it stands. I think that game yesterday was a really impressive all-round display. Maybe not all-round, actually, because Arsenal didn't create all that much an attack, and even there are great opportunities. It wasn't like clear-cut opportunities in the same way that, you know, they had three one-on-ones against Liverpool, or, you know, created some good opportunities against Man City. There wasn't that much, really, either side did in an attacking sense. But yeah, I thought they were magnificent defensively. I thought Gabriel was outstanding. I think he already looks like one of the top five centre-backs in the league, albeit in a position of real weakness in the Premier League and in the world right now. You know, I can name elite centre-backs on one hand, really, at the moment. But Partey, I feel like Arsenal completely dominated the Man United midfield. Thought, as you say, Elneny, where has he come from? Like, who is this Elneny? He's a different guy. He's now got so much more to his game than he did before he was left out, which either suggests he's really worked on his game in his time out of the side, or Arteta's getting a lot more out of him, both of which are great. And Partey made him look a hell of a lot better as well. And Partey covered the ground really well. They clearly won pretty much every duel in midfield. I thought McTominay was pretty much anonymous. I didn't think Fred was particularly good. And whatever's happened to Paul Pogba needs to be turned around really quickly. Although I do give Paul Pogba a little bit of breathing space in that, having had coronavirus myself, it really does take quite a lot out of you. And I wouldn't be surprised if he's still feeling the effects. Hasn't had a pre-season. I don't want to hammer him too much. But yeah, Partey and Elneny completely dominated the game. And Arsenal could have won by more. And it was just a really, really positive performance from them. But I thought Gabriel was really the outstanding player over Partey for me.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, Gabriel, I thought was very good as well. But I also thought he could have been sent off. So I was kind of... That kind of gives the midfield
that is
the,
true.
Edge, the edge from my point of view. I think arguably maybe he should have been sent off. But yeah, Partey's an interesting one, because a load of the stats guys kind of got in trouble over the summer for saying they didn't think Partey was very good. And when I was a little bit critical of the move for Partey, I always took pains to point out that my issue wasn't with him as a player. I kind of disagreed with them in that I thought that he was very good. And I think at Football Daily, we've hyped him up for probably a couple of years now, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, a long time.
Particularly once he kind of moved into that six role at Atletico Madrid, where I think he's been sensational. And it looks like he'll have a bit more freedom at Arsenal, probably because Arsenal's midfield is just less organised. My concern about it is the same as it was all along, which is it does not solve this creativity thing. Like you said, against Man United, we didn't really create much of anything. Like, yeah, there were a couple of opportunities that didn't turn into shots, so they won't appear on an XG map. You know, like you think of Bellerin fizzing that ball across that Aubameyang throws his foot at, and the one where Lindelof makes an absolutely incredible, you know, defensive intervention to take the ball off Lacazette's foot in the box. But the concern is creativity still. We saw it in the first half against Leicester, Arsenal mustered 11 shots, which is their best half this season, but they weren't particularly good quality, though Lacazette should probably have scored an open goal. And I don't know. I think that Partey kind of really helps shore up the midfield, makes the midfield more progressive, certainly stops teams waltzing through. On the other hand, I thought Man United were very, very bad, and I still do think that a really crucial signing needs to come in, or one or two of the youngsters have just got to take a huge leap forward. Like, we need to see, like, Emile Smith Rowe get started as a number 10 or something for this Arsenal side to truly be really, really good. I still look at them and I see their peak as probably a fifth or sixth place side, despite winning away at Old Trafford. So, Partey, very, very good. Obviously going to be great now. Obviously, we will see over the next few years how that signing kind of actually pans out, because I don't think you can really assess these signings anymore without seeing how they've done over the kind of lifetime of the contract. But yeah, do I think that it makes Arsenal great? I see a lot of crowing from Arsenal fans today, and I don't know, I still have my suspicions about where we'll end up this season. So I'm very glad that he's good to watch. It's nice to see a couple of Arsenal signings work out.
Yeah, And red boots always help as well. I think he looked really cool on the pitch as well, which always helps. I thought, I think for Arsenal's attack, which is quite... I just basically feel like Alex Lacazette is actually a really good player, but he's not a great goal scorer. I don't think he's really got, like... He's not lethal enough, basically. There's no sort of way around it. And actually, Willian... I don't know. So I'd rather almost see Pepe get a consistent run of games at right wing, to be honest. And then Aubameyang, there's very little creativity from the left-hand side either. So you're basically relying on Saka, wherever he is on the pitch, to be the most creative player. And he's generally done it okay this season so far. But it's not really a strategy for any long-term success. But that 3-4-3 with that composition of players on the wings and Willian sort of, you know, flattering to deceive slightly since that game against Fulham, which I thought he looked excellent in, but it was against Fulham, which is basically a free reign to do whatever you like. Then, I don't know. Arsenal's attack is just quite a long way away from being good, I feel, unless Aubameyang starts hitting everything into the net, which could happen, but it's not likely to happen.
Yeah, I don't know. It does certainly feel like there are issues of personnel, there are issues of system there. And I mean, we could be having a totally different conversation. Like, everybody was talking about how Arsenal were the better side and, you know, Partey was great and Gabriel was great and Elneny was great. But if Pogba doesn't foul Bellerin as he's running away from goal, then we're probably talking about a 0-0 draw. And at that point, everyone says, oh, well, you know, Arsenal are pretty good. Arsenal dominated the game, but didn't actually create anything. We're like a knife's edge from having that conversation instead. And I want to see where we are in January, because I do think that there's probably, unless Arsenal have changed formation, unless they found some creative talent from somewhere, I think there's probably going to be a pretty good argument for going into the market in January in an attempt to find some creativity.
Absolutely, I'd agree with that.
Yeah, so it seems like actually a lot of these transfers have kind of worked out, except for, surprise, surprise, the Juventus-Barcelona ones. And we'll obviously keep our eyes on Man City to see how those ones work out as well. Doogie, thank you very much for joining me today. What would you like to plug?
Why don't you go check out Continental Club on Euro Football Daily? We were discussing, you know, the wider malaise that seems to have affected La Liga so far this season, with the big boys pretty inconsistent. So we're diving into Real Madrid, Barcelona, and maybe, you know, giving some praise to João Felix and Atletico Madrid in particular, who look the most together of the top teams in La Liga. So yeah, go check that out on Euro Football Daily.
Yeah, sounds like a great one, because La Liga is like genuinely impossible to comprehend right now.
Weird.
Thank you very much to you guys for watching or listening. Obviously, if you do listen, then please go to Football Daily Podcast and subscribe to the YouTube channel as well. If you do watch, then maybe find us on a podcast app and subscribe there too. We really appreciate it. Thank you very much for supporting our podcast, and thank you, Doogie. We'll see you all next time. Bye.
Bye.